Coming up on Tech Nation, we combine Tech Nation and Biotech Nation as we broadcast from the 2016 International Biotechnology Convention in San Francisco. The buzz centers around the effects of repeated head injury, as evidenced in recent announcements regarding Muhammad Ali, as well as what can be done about the effects of opioid abuse, as in the case of Prince and millions worldwide. We see how the landscape of the global biotechnology industry is changing, the issue of drug pricing, national differences in intellectual property, and the challenge of drug-resistant bacteria. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2002, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made famous the term unknown unknowns. He started it by saying, there are things we know. Now that's easy enough to follow. We know when we know something. He called these the known knowns. From there, Rumsfeld also explained that there are some things we do not know. We know we don't know them, so this category, in his view, were the known unknowns. But his killer category was this one. The ones we don't know, we don't know. These are the famous unknown unknowns, to which he added, and if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is the latter category that tend to be the difficult ones. While he didn't know it, Donald Rumsfeld had summed up the long history of science. Scientists take what they know and try to imagine what is unknown about it, and their work is making that knowable. These are generally what Rumsfeld would call the known unknowns, like knowing that light travels mighty fast, but not knowing exactly how fast. For centuries, starting with Galileo and Beekman, scientists have tried to measure the speed of light, some more successfully than others, and often with new and innovative methods. Still, everyone agreed that light waves travel. That was a known. What was unknown was how fast. Yet science also deals with the unknown unknowns, and that, perhaps, is the most fun science of all. Take electrons. They weren't even discovered until 1897, and every electronic product within your reach, from your phone to your TV to your computer to the sensors in your car, all work because we understand electrons. They're the basis for electronics. Electrons, electronics, get it? But before J.J. Thomson could actually peg the electron, scientists and engineers perceived aspects of the phenomenon, and ultimately, with its understanding, they were able to harness it into the technology we would be hard-pressed to do without today. So science doesn't just try to measure the dimensions of what it knows it doesn't know. It's also looking for new unknowns everywhere, for new insights that would make no sense to earlier generations of scientists. Isaac Newton might have a hard time jumping into a conversation about leptons and quarks, but he would no doubt enjoy quickly catching up on several hundred years of scientific breakthroughs. The truth is, scientists love unknown unknowns, just as scientists have a reputation for never giving a definitive answer, driving non-scientists to distraction. The moment they discover something new, the moment they know something previously unknown, they speed ahead. How does it apply elsewhere? Where has the scientific frontier moved to? And what are all the new unknowns? It's interesting to think about science in company with the ruminations of Donald Rumsfeld. When you think about it, it's the nature of life. Even Silicon Valley, with its deep respect for the lessons of failure, also has a deep respect for the tenuousness of success. Even the most media-trumpeted achievement might have been close to a disaster, and nobody knew it. The unknown unknowns just didn't happen to rear their heads, and if they had, that success might well have been a failure. Knowing everything, accounting for everything, controlling everything is an illusion, but an illusion that man lives with on a day-to-day basis. The unknown unknowns are out there, and we all know it. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we broadcast from the 2016 International Biotechnology Convention in San Francisco. The topics are wide, including the long-term effects of head injury, battling opioid abuse, cocaine addiction, and overeating disorder, the continuing efforts with regard to drug-resistant bacteria, and the changing landscape of the global biotechnology industry. First, I speak with Jim Greenwood, the president and CEO of BIO, the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. Well, Jim, welcome back to Biotech Nation.
Always a pleasure. Every single year.
Absolutely. Every single year. And here we are at BIO 2016 in my hometown, San Francisco.
Where biotechnology was born.
It's true. The first thing, before we get into the conference this week, you've gone from the Biotechnology Industry Organization, and now you're the Biotechnology Innovation Organization.
Yes.
What's that mean?
I wanted to do that years ago, and I finally found a board chairman who jumped on the idea and said, do it. And for a couple of reasons. First off, it more accurately describes what we are and who we are. We're all about innovation. And of course, we're businesses, and of course, we have bottom lines, but we really are patient-focused and really innovation-focused. So I think it better describes who we are.
And people who are really into industry to make money don't go out and say, let's do an industry where the risk is high, may not see the first reward for 15 years after we bet the entire bank on. This is not a good industry to get into.
If you wake up one morning and say, I've got my MBA now, where's the lucrative place to go? It ain't here. I mean, people have made a lot of money in biotechnology, but 90% of companies fail, 90% of projects fail, and something like 80% of drugs that get approved never even recover their costs. So it's an interesting business.
But we're here.
We're here.
And we're going to do it. Now let's get to BIO 2016 here in San Francisco. Tell us about that.
Well, first time we've been back to San Francisco since 2004. The attendance has grown so much that we couldn't fit here anymore until the Moscone Center was expanded, which it has been now, so we are back. We have had 16,000 people here from 76 nations. And as we do every year, we broke the previous record for one-on-one meetings in our business forum, the partnering meetings. This year, 36,000 one-on-one meetings in 3.5 days.
You have to understand that if you could get a one-on-one meeting with someone, if you could get it and worked really hard, you have all the overhead of getting to the meeting, then getting their attention, and then all the overhead of going home. I mean, it's a beehive. It's an opportunity that you couldn't get any other way.
It's an extraordinarily efficient way to do it. And we always say it saves a whole lot of jet fuel because people don't have to get in jets and fly halfway around the country or halfway around the world to either meet with their existing partners or explore meeting new partners. And here, everyone comes here and everyone's very, very busy. And we have an extraordinarily brilliant system of scheduling these meetings, and people are thrilled. And as a result of that, people come to this convention for several days and they leave, and there's like practically exponential growth in the number of deals and understanding and learning, scientific, policy, business. It's a pretty important event.
And it crosses all those areas. Very unusual because it's science, it's government, it's policy, it's finance, it's you name it, and it's all here all together. But I do want to point out that BIO has the most interesting
exhibit areas because they're all broken up, not just by companies, but by regions. It's sort of like Disneyland. If you've ever been there, you look up, there's the Matterhorn, but I'm standing in Frontierland, and right behind me is like, it's like, well, I'm in Spain, and it's right next to Germany. No, right. it's right next to South Dakota.
Go into the pavilion and say, how do you get to Hong Kong? Well, go down to Pennsylvania, make a right, then go to Switzerland, make a left, and as you go past, you know, France, you'll see Hong Kong, you know.
And so all those people that are integrating at the meeting level then are also integrating in the exhibit area. And
it's an exciting place to be. We've intentionally adapted so people can do their partnering within the exhibit halls because the people who pay for those exhibit halls want traffic. And if everyone's all in another portion of the convention center doing that, they don't get to see all of this all these pavilions and talk to all these nice people.
You always have great keynotes. Who are the keynotes this year?
So this year, on Tuesday, I interviewed Will Smith, who played Dr. Omalo in the movie Concussion, and also Dr. Omalo was there. So we had a fabulous conversation about what Dr. Omalo is the guy who did the autopsy. He's from Nigeria, did an autopsy on a guy by the name of Iron Mike Webster, who was a Pittsburgh Steeler who had basically lost his mind. And when he did the autopsy and he took the brain out, it didn't look like a brain that was a victim of dementia, and so he, against the wishes of his supervisor, basically started trying to understand this, and then came up with this conclusion, which is that football players can very frequently come down with what he called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Okay, you don't have to have a concussion to get this. They figured that this guy, in the course of his career, probably had 70,000 head-on-head collisions. He was a center, and these guys bang against each other, and the G-forces are immense. And then Will Smith, you know, one of the most famous actors in the world and a delightful guy, played him. So we had that conversation. And then, of course, Will Smith had also played Muhammad Ali, who just passed away. So he brought that all in, and what does this teach us about Parkinson's, which is what Muhammad Ali had, also from, you know, perhaps from blows to the head. So that was cool.
Well, this is an election year, and let's remember you're the longtime representative from
Pennsylvania,
the state of Pennsylvania. What does this election year, what is it meaning in the biotech space?
So our industry has been under pressure on our pricing from the very beginning. I showed my board a montage of newspaper headlines criticizing drug pricing going back to 1897, all through the 20s and the 40s and the 60s and so forth. It comes with the territory. But it has never been like this before. And that's for a number of reasons. First off, we have lots more products. So there's more products to spend money on. More people are taking them. More people have access to them now because of entitlement programs and other things. Some of these are very expensive. And the fact of the matter is that if you're going to go into, as we talked earlier, and do an enterprise that is as risky as this one, and you expect to attract investors, be they venture capitalists or your stock is being traded in the public arena, the basic economics is that the high risk, high reward. So along comes Sovaldi, right? Cures hepatitis C, right? 3.6 million people in America have this disease, and it eventually destroys your liver. Hospitalization, okay? So Gilead has this great drug, and they price it at $1,000 a pill, basically. You take one a day for 7 weeks. That's 7 times 12 is – for 12 weeks. 7 times 12 is 84,000. Now, that was just a retail price, and it's negotiated down from there. But anyway, that made a – you know, a lot of pressure came because of that. And then comes our darling Martin Shkreli of touring fame and Valiant, and they become absurdly the face of the industry because touring takes a $15 drug or whatever it was and raises the price 15,000%, and it's a drug that people with AIDS take. So you
and
had all that.
Because there's no law preventing this.
There's no law preventing it, but it's not – nor is it innovation. And then you have the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, which has changed the rules for the insurance industry. And the insurance industry has had to raise its premiums, and nobody likes that. And so they decided quite consciously to blame the drug industry. All this is because drug prices are going up. In 2015, the net increase in drug pricing was 2.8%. Okay, insurance premiums went up more than twice that amount on average. So, and most of that is driven by hospitals and doctors. So they're pinning the tail on us anyway. So what this has meant is that starting with Bernie Sanders and going to Hillary Clinton, who famously in her first debate with Sanders said the last question was, in politics, people are often known by the enemies they make. Who are the enemies you're most proud of making? She says ISIS, the drug industry, and Republicans. Well,
then she, not a good list to be on.
She tweets out when Martin Shkreli happens. She tweets that out, and the Nasdaq biotech exchange went down 5%. And so, and even Donald Trump has said we need to negotiate drug pricing and so forth. So everybody's sort of hopping on that bandwagon. So if in fact the next Congress and or the next president decide to impose draconian price controls on our products, that will have a very predictable effect. The investors will go elsewhere, okay? And this comes at a time when the science is galloping. You know, there isn't a disease on this planet that our science will not eventually cure. We will cure the disease. But that we will only cure the disease if we have the investors who are willing to make those investments, okay? And so if you change the policy that so that they can't recover their investments at least sometimes, at least one out of 10 times, then innovation goes away.
Which goes to our earlier conversation. When it doesn't make it, they get nothing.
Right.
So, you know, this is a highly, highly risky business.
Right. And so now here in California, this fall, there's a referendum on the question, on the ballot that says that under certain circumstances, well, actually, it says the Medicaid program in the state of California will not pay any more for a drug than the Veterans Administration, which has congressionally demanded required low pricing to begin with. And now you have these transparency bills, all right? Members of the legislatures, this just happened in Vermont, they want to say, well, how much did it cost you to make that drug, right? And you have to submit that to the government, how much it cost you to make that drug. Okay, so how many of my failures do I get to include in that, right? So if I spend hundreds of millions of dollars, as our companies do, and completely fail, clinical trials don't work, and then finally one does, do I get to build that into my, you know, my transparency about costs? So we're under all this pressure. So if you go to a drugstore and you hand in your prescription, right, and you sit down, you read People magazine for 15 minutes, and the pharmacist says, okay, Mr. Jones, your prescription's ready, that'll be $300. You might go, he goes, $300? How's that? Well, the drug costs $1,000. This prescription costs $1,000. And your insurance company only covers 70%. So who is he mad at? Is he mad at the drug company because the drug costs $1,000? Or is he mad at the insurance company for not covering it? And we think that maybe he ought to be mad at his insurance company because that's not really insurance, right? And what we see happening is insurance companies doing that because they don't want him in their plan anyway. You know why? Because he's sick, okay? And insurance companies don't like sick people.
They like rich and healthy people.
They like people who pay their premiums and don't get sick. It's like that Liberty auto insurance commercial where the woman says, you know, you pay your premiums month after month, year after year. Then you have an accident. And guess what? You want to use your insurance? You have to pay him more. You know, why buy insurance? So, you know, I think the insurance industry needs to take a look at itself. And I think the policymakers need to take a look at the insurance industry and say, you know, why are you really doing that?
And I think to your point about saying, well, how much did this drug really cost? I think that it has to be looked at in a total. That's the whole system has to be looked at,
right,
about what is driving what. What? How does this all work together? And that's the only way to a solution. Otherwise, you end up skewing it by the questions you ask and skewing it by the particular myopic laws you might pass.
Exactly. And 70% of biotechnology occurs in this country, right? We lead the world in this. And there's a reason for that. It's because we're practically the only semi-free market left when it comes to drug pricing. You know, if you want to have cheap drugs, that's easy. Just pass the laws, set the prices, and you'll have all the cheap drugs you want. You just won't have any new ones, which means Sorry about your Alzheimer's disease. Sorry about your diabetes. Sorry about your cancer. Sorry about your Parkinson's. Sorry about your ALS. Nobody wants to invest in us anymore because we're now price controlled.
And I like the image of science is galloping, and it really is. And it's galloping because of all the investment the government has made. It's galloping because of all the investment the private companies have made. It's galloping because of the investment of private foundations. And it's galloping because the scientists are just out there wanting to do all this. You put the brakes on that. You know, we're in a very fortunate spot because the rest is economics. And those are laws of man, not laws of nature.
And
you've got to solve it. Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, we're 14% of the healthcare spend, okay? And we're the only part of the healthcare spend that really saves the system money because we keep all these people out of the hospital, right? So think of all of these hepatitis C patients who get cured, right? They're not going to show up in a $1,000 a day hospital bed for 3 months, right? So we're the solution to the healthcare problem, not the,
don't
not
shoot
the
us.
Problem. Right? Don't kill the cure.
Don't kill the cure. Well, that's great. So next year, San Diego.
We'll be in San Diego. Another, you know, California is the state where biotechnology was born, here in San Francisco, and it is the state where most of the largest number of companies are. Boston's also a major hub, is North Carolina and other places. But San Diego is really rich in biotech companies, particularly small startup companies, and it's a wonderful place to be, and we'll be there.
Yeah, I want to see you next year with the sunglasses, the Hawaiian shirt. Can you do that?
Well, we do have good parties.
And we do.
When we go to San Diego, we rent out that aircraft carrier down there.
The Midway.
And last year when we were there, we had sort of a World War II theme. So we had Rosie the Riveter. We had about 10 Rosie the Riveters up on scaffolding, swinging back and forth.
I don't know what that was about, but okay.
And we have guys in white T-shirts.
Yeah, what do you got for me?
We have them peeling potatoes and juggling and trampolining and fireworks and food and dancing.
Hey, Jim, always a pleasure, and see you next year in San
Diego.
Okay,
thanks so much for having me again.
I've been speaking with Jim Greenwood, the president and CEO of BIO, the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. Next up is the annual publication of Scientific American Worldview. Mike May is its editorial director, while Yali Friedman is the head of data analytics.
Well, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's
always
good to be here.
It's just great for you to be here because we're talking about the whole world of all this biotech. It's really fantastic. Now, let me start with you, Mike. What is new this year?
Well, you make the point of the whole world, and that's always the entire point of worldview. But the fact that it's the whole world means that it's tricky to try to look at this in some way and make sense of it. You've got a lot of data here, and a lot of our objective this year was to make new tools, new ways for people to look at that data and to try to understand it and also to compare it. So on top of the worldview scorecard in particular, which Yali will talk about in a minute, we also developed this idea of having a little piece on each country. And so there's a little section for each of the 54 countries that makes it easy to analyze their data in terms of that country and also how they compare to everybody else. It's like a one-stop shop for that particular – a one-spot stop for that for that country so that you can actually look and see how they did and get a little brief summary of their performance in biotech.
Well, anytime I ask for a company, I go, well, where are you and what are you doing where? Because a lot of them are multi-country, and that tells you why frequently when you go and look at the context.
Well, I think in this particular case, we've constantly been evolving toward better ways to present these data, new ways visually to present them, new ways to explain them. And I think this year we've done that in pretty much completely different ways than we have in the past. And I think it's a lot easier for a reader to come in, take a look, get a lot more information than they could in the past. But at the same point, it's set up. So if you want to take some time, there's a lot of digging you can do too.
Now, of course, I'm a numbers gal. I just love the scorecard every year. Yali, tell us about this scorecard.
Sure. So this year we see that the top five countries remain unchanged, but there's a change in the ranking. So the United States is still first. Singapore has moved up five spots to second place. And Denmark, New Zealand, Australia close out the top five.
Well, what's up with Singapore?
It's a small country, so it bounces around a lot. It doesn't take a lot for the per capita metrics to really get thrown around. But what we have seen is that when you measure the countries in absolute numbers, not in terms of ranking, the United States is above its 8-year average, but most of the other countries are dropping below their 8-year averages. So it appears that there is a split happening.
Wow. Haves and have-nots. Do and do not. Yeah. Now, what did Singapore do in the biotech field? Is it producing drugs? Is it more in research? What are we talking about?
It's very strong in the fundamentals. Drug development is largely a Western-dominated thing. America, Western Europe, and Japan. Singapore has very good education. They have very strong fundamentals, very good enterprise support. And so these are all the things which you have to have in place before you do develop drugs. But for the size of the nation, it's very difficult to expect them to actually be developing a substantial number of drugs.
And Singapore has made a real effort. It's not only invested money in this sector, it's committed to bringing people there from all over the world. I mean, this is what happens when you really get an initiative out and you get money behind it.
You actually raise an interesting point. It's a discussion we were having earlier this week about the difference between a planned economy and a free market economy. And in the United States, biotechnology largely developed by accident. Just phenomenally strong fundamentals, but no direct actions, no national plans to develop biotechnology or strengthen it. It just happened. And then you have across the globe these other countries which are taking very strong planned approaches, and each one should bear different sorts of fruit. It's been a lot of fun to watch.
Anybody else make any big changes up or down?
Yeah, Israel moved up 5 positions. It's the biggest gainer this year. And Puerto Rico took a nosedive and went down 17 spots.
Whoa, what happened?
It's just...
Is this the debt issue?
It's too quick for debt to have an impact. But the only way you drop that much is by having multiple measures all start slipping.
And what slipped? Because they're huge in manufacturing, not much in innovation coming out of there, new one, for particular reasons. But what changed?
I think that's it, what you're saying about manufacturing. They had very favorable laws. Ireland is facing a similar issue. So Puerto Rico had very, very favorable laws for manufacturing for pharmaceuticals. And when the tax credits for those expired, things started to move off the island. Ireland likewise had very favorable laws for tax havens for headquarters. And what we've seen in public markets is that all of the top 10 countries have seen improvements in their public markets, except for Ireland, which has slipped for the second year in a row.
The numbers are the numbers.
Yeah. And it comes back to what we're saying about planned versus free market economies, is that when you have these artificial market distortions, when the policies go away, what's left?
I'm speaking with Mike May, the editorial director of Scientific American Worldview, and Yali Friedman, head of data analytics. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at technation.com, Stitcher, iTunes, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, more from the International Biotechnology Convention 2016 in San Francisco. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Mike May, the editorial director of Scientific American Worldview, and Yali Friedman, head of data analytics.
Puerto Rico had very, very favorable laws for manufacturing for pharmaceuticals. And when the tax credits for those expired, things started to move off the island. Ireland likewise had very favorable laws for tax havens for headquarters. And what we've seen in public markets is that all of the top 10 countries have seen improvements in their public markets, except for Ireland, which has slipped for the second year in a row.
The numbers are the numbers.
Yeah, and it comes back to what we're saying about planned versus free market economies, is that when you have these artificial market distortions, when the policies go away, what's left? If you haven't built up the foundations, everyone might just go somewhere else.
Really good point. People don't seem to understand that, for instance, if we have a jobs bill, at the end of the jobs bill, not only do you have your job, but it created an economy around it so the job would continue, not, oh, no more money. You know, it's like they're two different kinds of job bills, if you will, or initiatives. Same with any of these economic incentives. There has to be the insight from the start how it's actually starting something that will continue.
Exactly. It requires very long-term thinking. And it's a long, long story, but Cuba is a great example of that. When the Soviet Union shut down and the average Cuban lost 20% of their body mass, Fidel continued to invest in biotechnology, and it's why they punch above their weight.
Now tell us about Cuba. We're dying to know. Now that we can go there,
that's right.
Technology.
Well, we don't have a lot of stats on Cuba, unfortunately. And that actually is a great segue to something we've added this year, which is the Latin American scorecard. And because we don't have enough data on the Latin American countries, on some of the Latin American countries, to include them in the overall scorecard, we just decided to make a second scorecard just for Latin America. And so we compare a good number of countries and see where they lie. And so far, the reception has been quite positive. Countries which haven't been ranked before are happy to see that we now do count them, and they now know where they can start planning their policies to move forward.
Now we're actually looking closer at regions. It used to be just a few countries here and there on your list. We're starting to see them come up. Do you think that you'll continue with the Latin American scorecard as an example?
We'd very much like to. I think depending on the reception of the model of building a separate scorecard with a separate set of factors going into it, it still can be very valuable. And what we're seeing as well is that some of these countries are now recognizing the importance of joining these global data groups like the OECD and feeding their data to them so that they can be ranked. The mini scorecard is sort of like a stepping stone along the way that helps them bridge that gap and start to get into the larger data collection so they can be recognized on the global scene.
I really am hip to the beat on this in the sense that I try to tell both companies and regions, whatever the industry organization or the regional economic development people are, it's like you've got to pay attention to who's developing database bases, who's developing industry reports, and you've got to get in there and make sure they have your data. And you have to make sure you're telling the truth on top of that. Have you had any experiences, we won't name names, with people feeding you data or seeing data that's not quite up to par?
No, but you actually once again raise a great point that came from a discussion earlier this week. We were meeting with a country who were looking to enact certain policies to see how their scorecard numbers could be advanced. And I told them, I said, we're tough. And so the scorecard was always designed in such a way that you can't just raise one number. There's always checks and balances inside the scorecard. So when we measure intellectual property, for example, one thing which a lot of countries want to do is improve their intellectual property. But we measure not only the absolute metrics of intellectual property, as in what things are protected and how are they protected, but also how do business leaders perceive the intellectual property in a country. And so you may have countries where the laws are written in one way but are interpreted in another way by the courts, and we capture both sides of that.
And I also appreciate how at the very end you have a big list of here are all the references we have. We're not talking about, well, we just go over here and look at the data. You have a very rich fabric of references that together you can't fool all the people all the time. You can't fool all the references all the time. So if you want to change things and you think you may have been misrepresented – go and look at all the references. Deal with them. You know, whether you're an individual company or inside a cluster or the cluster itself, it's an issue. it's an issue, and you've got to be upfront with it.
Yeah, after 8 years, I've got a lot of experience defending the methodology.
Yeah, you don't look like – you don't have too many Band-Aids on your face, and you know, it's like you look like you came through it all right. I'm just in living fear that you're going to have a whole lot more countries right now, because at the very end, you actually combine all the scorecards, goes across two pages, and it gets much bigger. I'm not going to be able to see it. Mike, do you think you'll have a fold-out at that point?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I mean, that's part of the reason for adding the pieces where you can look individually at each country to really help you be able to do that and to try to present it in ways that sort of a gestalt understanding the data, so to speak. I think that helps with that somewhat.
Yeah, and you can do a real deep dive on this data here.
Absolutely. You know, we should mention, too, we've discussed a lot about Singapore, and we're talking about the numbers of Singapore. Also recently, Scientific American Custom Media did a standalone publication just on Singapore that actually came out with the June issue of the monthly magazine. That'd be an interesting place for people to look, too, for sort of a different kind of look at what's going on in innovation in Singapore as well.
And what are you looking at? What are the characteristics? Sometimes you look at this and say, you know, we've completely ignored this portion. No wonder there's a weakness here.
Right. In this particular publication, we looked at everything from government impact on sort of the society, science, all the way to things like artists in Singapore and innovation on that side. So it was pretty broad.
Well, given this publication of given this year's publication of Scientific American Worldview, Mike, just, you know, some closing thoughts here on what's new.
Well, there are at least a couple things that people should take a look at, I think, outside the scorecard that we have this year that will be of interest. One is a piece on using social media in biotech. So the short answer is sort of go social or go home. But this is actually a piece that's a little bit of a DIY social media for biotech, or more like do's and don'ts that I think people will find interesting to take a look at. And we even have like a list of like, I think, seven sort of things you should do. And then also we have a piece that looks at the issue of reproducibility of data. And here we just really Q&A'd about half a dozen experts asking them, how bad do you think the reproducibility problem is and what do you think we should do?
Okay, now, here's the $64,000 question. How much does this cost?
Well, we had to keep it the same price as last year, so it's free 365 days a year, and you can download it online.
Free is a very good price.
Absolutely.
That's at saworldview.com, right?
Correct.
Well, guys, thank you so much. Hope to see you next year, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having us. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Mike May, the editorial director of Scientific American Worldview, and Yali Friedman, head of data analytics. The Scientific American 2016 Worldview Report can be obtained at no cost at saworldview.com. With all the news about opioid overdoses and with the untimely death of Prince, people are beginning to understand that this is a very real and challenging problem. Dr. Roger Crystal is the CEO of Opiant Pharmaceuticals. Opiant works in the area of opioid antagonists. I asked him, what does that mean and how does it work?
Opioid antagonists block the opioid system in the brain, and the opioid system is associated with reward, and it causes the release of dopamine when activated. That's what really causes addictive behavior in general, and we're very interested in treating that as a company. Our aim is to treat and develop treatments for addictions, substance use disorders, and eating disorders. What we've done in a situation of opioid overdose, we recognize, and it's well known, that if you overdose on them, they impact the opioid system in the breathing center of the brain. And that's what results in patients to stop breathing if you overdose.
I see. Okay, so now you're working with something called opioid antagonists. What are those?
So they're blocking the opioid receptors in the brain. You have several opioid receptors, not just in the reward center of the brain, but also in that breathing center. So the Narcan nasal spray blocks the effects of opioids on the brain. So what's happening if you overdose on opioids, they can't get to those receptors. So the brain is able to tell the body to keep breathing.
Ah, so that's the you're in overdose mode, but because of that nasal spray, then it doesn't matter. It'll just keep passing it by.
Absolutely.
Now, how long does that effect work?
So that's a great question, because the drug that we're using for Narcan nasal spray is naloxone. Naloxone has actually been approved for decades as an injection, and the your duration, where if you like, how long it's present in meaningful levels in the blood is about an hour. That's really important because what we're seeing now is that more and more people are overdosing on longer-acting opioid painkillers, which perhaps last longer than the time that naloxone's around for a meaningful point of time. So in theory, we don't have the clinical data to prove this, but in theory, if patients don't get the definitive help in a hospital, then they could fall back and their breathing could slow down again, which is why the product actually has two shots, two doses, two nasal spray devices to ensure that if a patient doesn't respond or if they go back and stop breathing again, that there's additional help on hand. I think that's particularly important in situations in more rural environments where it might take quite a while for them to get to the ER.
So this would be given to EMTs, fire departments, police officers, you name it.
Well, it's a very interesting question because those are the existing users of naloxone as an injection. And for all the existing users, they are still unwilling in certain situations to use needles because of the high risk in certain patient populations of associated diseases such as HIV. However, once you have the product as a nasal spray, then you unlock the market beyond just the existing user base. So we see great potential for addicts themselves to be supplied with a nasal spray. And should they overdose, then they can have the drug administered by a bystander. It's not a massive ask to spray something up someone's nose compared to injecting it into the body. And there's about 1 million people in the United States who are either on methadone or taking buprenorphine-like products, such as Suboxone. So they're quite widespreadly used, and in many ways, unfortunately. But beyond that, the numbers are really quite staggering because in the United States, there's 250 million opioid prescriptions every year to about 15 to 30 million unique users. So that's quite an extraordinary number of people who are all at risk of opioid overdose because they're taking opioid painkillers. And our belief is that over time, we would like to see the equivalent of the EpiPen, the antidote, being prescribed alongside anyone who's taking an opioid painkiller. And our commercial partner, Adapt Pharma, we know that that's an area that they're very interested in too.
You didn't just stop there, although that took you a number of years to get there, and congratulations for that.
Well, it's pretty remarkable. We actually went from concept to approval in 3 years, so that's pretty
swift. It's a record-breaking short period. Very swift, very swift. And now you're looking at other addictions, such as you say, binge eating and cocaine addiction. Are they relevant, or are those
absolutely
different? Let me ask you, just to interrupt you right there, what exactly is binge eating disorder?
So binge eating disorder is the commonest of the eating disorders. So we have bulimia, we have anorexia, we have binge eating disorder. It's, I would say, risen to prominence in recent years because it's now officially in the DSM-5, which is the, if you like, the manual that physicians and psychiatrists in particular refer to when coding for diagnoses. And there is now a treatment that's approved and on the market already, which is Shire's product Vyvanse. So that has previously been approved in ADHD, and now it's also approved for binge eating disorder. The disease itself is the ability to overeat with a lack of control of eating certain foods. Patients have real feelings of almost they're very distraught and distressed by their behavior. Someone who has binge eating disorder will typically binge 3 or 4 times, even more, per week, and each binge can last a couple of hours. So they can consume thousands of calories in a very short time frame. And I will add that bulimia nervosa is somewhat related, but that's more of a purging disorder as well. And we're very interested in how this technology can work in bulimia too. So to just go back on binge eating disorder, the other feature is whilst it's not about weight loss, we're not trying to develop a product to lose weight. There is a huge association with binge eating disorder, as you'd expect, and obesity.
Now, you're also looking at cocaine addiction. Mm. How does that relate in all this?
So cocaine use disorder, again, is an addiction. It's a very difficult disorder to treat, and there are no approved medications in this area. We had the opportunity to collaborate with NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse, and the University of Pennsylvania to do a very early stage study, clinical study, on cocaine addicts to see if our opioid nasal spray technology, opioid antagonist nasal spray technology, can in fact influence the blood flow in the brain of such patients. Because if we do see that when patients get their typical cues to take cocaine, when they administer a nasal spray opioid antagonist, if they get a reduction in blood flow as measured by this scan called a functional MRI, then that would be very encouraging and support us to do larger clinical trials in this area. But I don't want to, at this stage, be
don't
highly confident.
Don't get your hopes up.
Because nothing to date has worked very well in cocaine use disorder.
What's interesting here is we have the intervention at the time when there's overdose, sort of in everything we're talking about here. And then we have, okay, we have to get you past the overdose. Mm. After the overdose, you still have the problem.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That's a long-term focus for you.
Mm. Absolutely. And so for patients who are opioid dependent, whether that's heroin or some of the opioid painkillers, in fact, for a lot of patients, it's well recognized that at the point of when they overdose and are resuscitated, that represents quite an optimal time to start intervening and trying to take them off opioids and manage their addiction. And whilst we don't have an active program that we are publicly discussing in this space, it's not unreasonable to consider that this would be an area we're also very interested in. And I might add that whilst the company name is Opiant, and therefore the core focus is around opioid antagonists, and we're very overall very excited about the nasal spray delivery, that we're not beholden to that only. And we see some very encouraging technologies now starting to emerge. I might add that my background is a surgeon, and I've done a lot of work in oncology in the past. I see addiction today as really where oncology was probably 20, 30 years ago. So there's this great opportunity here to start developing novel treatments to almost, if I use the real estate analogy, to start thinking of an up-and-coming area in the housing
market.
Location,
location, and location.
What is location? I think what's interesting, and we're seeing this as we start to develop our clinical studies, is to compare and contrast what's a very exciting and promising area of immuno-oncology, where the limitation for some of these companies is getting access to patients because there's such a crowded space with perhaps the addiction space, where it's fairly bereft of significant clinical trial activity overall. And we're able to, dare I say, benefit from that, because any studies that we want to do, there's huge unmet need to get their patients into treatments that might be effective.
Well, Roger, this has been terrific. Please come back. See us anytime. You're always welcome on Biotech Nation.
Thank you very much, Moira. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Roger Crystal, the CEO of Opiant Pharmaceuticals. More information is available on the web at opiant.com. That's O-P-I-A-N-T, opiant.com. Next up is Gareth Williams, a partner at Marks & Clark International Intellectual Property Firm and editor-in-chief of a series of Marks & Clark Life Sciences reports. Gareth, welcome back to Biotech Nation.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Now, we've had a number of reports from Marks & Clark. We don't have one this year. I don't care about that. We still have lots of things
well,
to talk
about. Well, that's good. I'm glad we haven't disappointed you.
Now, last year it was on microbes, wasn't it, a bacteria?
Yes, yeah. We had a section in last year's topic about antibiotics and the levels of innovation in that field, and particularly comparison with other technologies, one of which was orphan diseases. And you could see very different levels of innovation in the two fields, like primarily because orphan diseases has a lot of government incentives behind developing treatments for that. So an antibiotic, new developments are fairly low. So the question is, what can we do about that? But then more recently, in May this year, the UK published a report on antimicrobial resistance with a number of recommendations on how to deal with the topic.
I must say that the UK is the most advanced country when it says we are going to look at the resistance to our present antibiotics and how we use it and really address it directly. I'm very impressed with just how much work is going on there.
It is quite impressive, but it's important to know that it's not just a UK issue. It's a UK report, but it's quite clear that we need global cooperation and international assistance to help combat this, because obviously antibiotic resistance is a worldwide problem.
What kind of recommendations came out of that report?
Interestingly, developing new antibiotics is probably not the key recommendation.
Not more of the same?
Not more of the same.
Not bigger, better? We're going
to... There are issues like government incentives and providing global funds, but I think one of the key recommendations from the report was developing new rapid diagnostic tests so that when a patient comes to their doctor, the doctor can do a test there and then and firstly confirm that they have an infection which requires antibiotic treatment and which type of antibiotic would be effective. So it's not so much getting new antibiotics or new therapies, although that is one of the strands, but it's using the ones we have more effectively and more smart.
Well, there are so many bacteria and there are so many ways to do diagnostics to figure this out. This is a big field.
Absolutely. But it's important to cover the whole range of different bacteria. But you'll find that most significant diseases such as TB or sexually transmitted infections are caused by a few different types of bacteria. But it's not so much the specific species of bacterium, it's which resistance they might have. Because resistance spreads between different bacteria, which is the problem. So the diagnostic test to be developed, there'll be a whole different range, but one of which would obviously be to look for specific resistance genes, and then it doesn't matter which specific infection you have, it's just can that bacterium be treated with a given drug?
The one you got.
Yes.
The only one I care about is the one I got.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Well, and we do need to remind people that unlike humans, we don't exchange DNA, but bacteria do.
Bacteria do so, all the time.
And so if they have a DNA, they figured out how to be resistant to a particular antibiotic, they can pass it to other bacteria in the neighborhood.
Yes,
and
indeed.
You really have a problem. That's why resistance is so strong.
Yeah, and it's also not just a human problem. Obviously, antibiotics are used quite widely in agriculture and farming. And a number of the significant, very frightening, multiple drug-resistant bacteria were first found in animals in agriculture. Just a few weeks ago, they found the first bacterial infection resistant to colistin, one of the antibiotics of last resort, in both humans and in animals. They found those infections in the USA.
Not in the UK. How convenient for you, Gareth.
I think it has already been found in the UK.
Oh,
you're
okay.
Just making news because it's spreading.
That's good. I think that, all joking aside, what we're looking at is if they find it, they know it can spread. Bacteria is everywhere. It spreads everywhere. And so we have to be totally vigilant. And yet, if I sit there and I think about diagnostics, it's like, is it a machine? Is it a little blood test? What are we talking about here?
Yes. Well, it can be everything. I mean, fundamentally, so as a patent attorney, intellectual property attorney, I look at things from the perspective of what's patentable, what's protectable. So a diagnostic test, you might want to protect a method of looking for a specific gene, but you can also equally well protect a kit, so a small plastic disposable item which you would test the patient with, or ways of treating blood samples. So it covers the whole range. But one of the problems is obviously different countries approach patentability differently. So some things might be protectable in one country but not in another. And harmonizing that is obviously a good thing for a global problem, getting global cooperation.
And before we have it all harmonized, if you have a really good diagnostic, how many patents and protectable actions do you have to take or protecting actions do you have to take in how many countries to get sort of most of the market?
Well, most of the market is kind of an open question because obviously, again, antibiotic resistance, AMR, is a worldwide problem. A lot of the resistance issues are in the developing world where you wouldn't necessarily have a big market for your product. And the biggest market's usually Europe, US, China, Japan. I think the big intellectual property difference between the US and the rest of the world is the patentability of diagnostic methods, as I said. So the US Supreme Court some years ago ruled that natural products and natural phenomena are not patentable. But the way that's being applied is that a natural phenomenon includes recognizing that there's a correlation between, say, gene sequence X and resistance to antibiotic Y. So if you find a test for looking for that gene, then it may not be patentable in the US. Hopefully that will change soon. There is another Supreme Court case pending for, again, a diagnostic test to carried out on looking for fetal abnormalities. But the problem with patenting that was what the test looks for is a particular fetal DNA sequence in maternal blood. And the presence of that was held by the courts so far to be a natural phenomenon and so not patentable. But as I said, that case is before the Supreme Court at the moment, so hopefully it will change. Looking at the other side of things in Europe, then patentability is fairly routine. Diagnostic methods are patentable, so the same test looking for a particular gene, a particular bacterium, is not a problem patenting in Europe. Devices and diagnostic kits are patentable everywhere, so that's not really a problem.
Many people say, oh, I hate all this patent stuff. Just, you know, things should be free. Well, if we can't patent it, then we can't create business value. And so even though we have the technology, it doesn't go anywhere. And we need the technology.
Correct. At the risk of shooting my own career in the foot, patents are not the whole story. Definitely in the medical field, government incentives for innovation do also help. This was another recommendation of the UK report, that we need to find other ways of incentivizing development. So the report talks about setting up drug funds to stimulate development, or the other approach, which has been very successful in the field of orphan diseases, is additional market exclusivity protection. So if you're the first to come to market with a particular drug or particular therapy, then you will get a certain time of market exclusivity regardless of your patent position. But yes, certainly it would be nice if drugs were free, but that's not the way the world works, unfortunately.
No, change the world, but right now this is what we have. And of course, you know, if your job doesn't work out, you can always come be a producer on TechNation.
Thank you, very good.
Thank you, Gareth. Please come back, see us again.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Gareth Williams, a partner at Marks & Clark International Intellectual Property Firm. More information is available at marks-clark.com. Many thanks to the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. More information is available on the web at bio.org. Our crew for Bio 2016 is Senior Producer Olga Levin, Associate Producers Sarah Ives, Stephanie Martin, and Cale Reed. Special thanks to our audio engineer, Larry Upton. A great note of appreciation is due to Bruce Jeanette and the San Francisco offices of DLA Piper for providing studio space throughout the Bio 2016 conference. DLA Piper is a global multinational law firm with offices in more than 30 countries. More information is available on the web at dlapiper.com. For TechNation and for BioTechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Anne Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.